This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
I was born almost half a century ago, ensconced in the project of civilization. Without thinking, I switch on a light, drive my car, and shop at supermarkets that are ready 24 hours a day to satisfy my every need and impulse. With the specter of industrial civilization now in the crosshairs of peak oil and climate change, I've become obsessed with the notion of collapse. From Joseph Tainter's Collapse of Complex Societies, Jared Diamond's Collapse, How Societies Choose to Fail, to Michael Ruppert's movie Collapse, there is a growing pessimism about the ability of societies to adapt in time. There is even a term for individuals like myself, collapsitarians. In the fall of 2011, I spent 2 weeks living with Dr. Guy McPherson, author of Walking Away from Empire and Professor Emeritus from the University of Arizona.
This is the story of how the West was lost.
What's the answer?
The answer is to terminate the industrial economy as quickly as possible.
Dr. McPherson is focused on decoupling from the industrial monolith through relocalization. He introduced me to groups and individuals who are quietly preparing for just such contingencies. What comes to mind are bug-out bags and guns and ammo survivalists. However, much more powerful are the transition movements that are occurring spontaneously around the world.
That's a clip from the upcoming movie Somewhere in New Mexico, Before the End of Time, by Mike Sosaby. Our feature-length interview with the film's inspiration, Guy McPherson, is coming right up. I'm Alex Smith, and this is Radio EcoShock. It's beyond the point where a few doomer voices say our way of life is rotten, that industrial civilization may be driving straight towards catastrophe. Most of you and I, well, we can see the signs for ourselves. But we are addicted to fossil power. We slide daily back into that easy life. Why can't we change or at least walk away? Dr. Guy McPherson did just that. He left his position as a professor of natural resources and ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Arizona. Guy is now a focal point for people searching for survival, for transition, for a reality-based way of life. Guy, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. It's a pleasure to be with you.
You know, I've been a fan of your blog, Nature Bats Last, for years. I almost made it to your experimental acres in the New Mexico hills. I was going to interview you at home, I thought, maybe as one of your tourists, but we ran out of time and gas money on the northern edge of Arizona. And, you know, it was over 100 degrees there, 38 degrees Celsius in the shade in early June. There was a huge coal plant busting out the energy nearby. So my first question for you, Guy, can Arizona survive without air conditioning?
That's a great question, and I suspect Arizona will be fine without air conditioning. I'm not so sure about Arizonans, though, especially more recent version of Arizonans. In 1491, there were several hundred, maybe even a few thousand people living in Arizona and getting along just fine. But of course, we've pretty dramatically altered the landscape since then. So I think there's some tough days ahead for people who have come to rely upon air conditioning as part of their way of life.
And everybody does. I mean, people leave their cars and trucks running while they're in shopping because they want it to be cool enough to sit down without burning themselves. Well, look, suppose I made it to your retreat, let's call it, or to your acreage, and we're walking around. Take us on a radio tour. What will you show us?
Well, it's a good thing we have quite a bit of time, because there's a lot to see here. There are many gardens. Many of these gardens are what I call high-intensity beds. That means I excavated all the soil out of the ground, put in a basket of hardware cloth to keep the gophers from digging down and coming up into the garden, and then putting the soil back into the garden. So So that's a huge amount of excavation all done with a pick and shovel. Lots and lots of those beds, lots of beds that aren't so well protected from pocket gophers but are protected from javelina, which is a native medium-sized mammal that lives here. Looks something like a pig, although it's not related to a pig or a hog. So we have four very large garden areas. We have an orchard with 100 or so fruit and nut trees in it. We have a chicken coop with 27 chickens, 24 laying hens, and some roosters. We have a goat shed that contains two milking does and currently four kids. We have a duck house that contains 14 ducks. That's where they come in at night. They spend all day outdoors foraging, as do the chickens. And currently we have three heirloom turkeys on the property that roost up in a tree at night. In addition, we have an off-grid straw bale house that's heated with passive solar. And we have an old 1995 double-wide mobile home on the property as well. It's used primarily for storage. So a few structures, a couple of solar wells that are driven by solar pumps, and rainwater harvesting off both roofs, off the double-wide mobile home and off of the now four-year-old straw bale house. In addition to that, there's a couple of greenhouses and a couple of cold frames and probably a half a dozen things I can't remember right now.
Where's the water for those wells coming from?
It's all groundwater. The static water level here is about 20 feet. We're relatively close to the last free-flowing river in the state of New Mexico. It's less than a quarter mile away as I look out my window. And so the static ground level of the water is about 20 feet down. So it doesn't require much energy to pull that water out of the ground.
And you've basically been describing water and food and shelter, and I know from previous interviews that I've heard of yours, you talk about the basic four needs. Do you want to list those out for us, and then maybe we'll talk about some of them?
Yeah, I think we need four things to thrive, and we need those things to thrive in any era, including currently, although most Americans in particular think we need a lot more things than that. The big four for me are clean water, healthy food, the ability to maintain body temperature, and development and maintenance of a decent human community. We're working pretty hard to secure all four of those elements here, and I think we've made pretty good progress over the last several years.
Okay, so let's start out with that question of maintaining body temperature. I think that's one of the biggies in our fossil fuel dependency. In the South, people need to keep cool enough. In the North, it's a matter of getting through the winter. And as far as I know, it's not really feasible to heat millions of homes in Chicago or Toronto with solar or wind power. So I have to wonder, can we really keep hundreds of millions of North Americans or Russians or Northern Europeans alive without fossil fuels?
It would surprise me very much if we could. I think we're deep into human population overshoot. We've been in human population overshoot since the first civilization arose several thousand years ago, as described by William Catton in his book Overshoot, which came out in 1980. So we've known about this for a while. We grow deeper into human population overshoot at the level of planet Earth by more than 200,000 people a day, each and every day. That's birth minus death. Are we going to be able to maintain that? I don't see any way we could. I don't see any way we want to keep ratcheting up the overshoot every day, given the consequences for the living planet on which we actually depend for our lives.
Well, you know, this is something that drives me crazy about news coverage, for example, of Japan. They say, well, the population is aging. It's not replacing itself. Oh, dear, this is terrible. It's awful. And I'm thinking, well, maybe they have a chance then because there will be fewer people living on that island. Maybe eventually they'll get to the point where the actual resources of the island could feed them and keep them warm.
Yes, absolutely. And ecologists have been writing about and speaking about limits to growth since ecology was created as a discipline. It's not that any of these ideas are new, but the politicians and the mainstream media, they're either untouchable or they are beyond the pale of the kinds of things we're willing to talk about. So, yes, let's stop the overshoot and let's try to learn to live on this planet, of which we have one.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Dr. Guy McPherson, the University of Arizona professor who left academia to find a more sustainable life. You can find his blog, Nature Bats Last, at guymcpherson.com. Guy, you had it nailed at the university. You were tenured with a pension and all the perks, including a lot of recognition for your books and your teaching. Why did you leave, and how did your academic peers react to that?
Yes, I did have it made. It was a pretty easy gig, and I was paid quite a bit of money. For the last several years at the university, though, I was pointing out the dark underbelly of industrial civilization. And it is difficult to point out that dark underbelly and live at the apex of empire. Tucson, Arizona is the apex of empire. Tucson transports its water uphill across the desert in open canals, 335 miles. Transports in all of its food, transports in all of its water, transports in all of its fossil fuels to keep it cool enough to survive in the summer, warm enough to survive in the winter, and on and on. It's increasingly challenging to point all that out and what the costs of that way of living include and continue to live that way and also look at yourself in the mirror. So I left because I think there's a moral imperative to the way we conduct our lives, and living in Tucson, Arizona didn't match that imperative for me. I left as an act of resistance, consistent with my baby boom generation of the 60s and 70s, in which it was resistance that got us out of the Vietnam War and gave us the environmental legislation that became the envy of the world and gave us the civil rights legislation that became the envy of the civilized world, and so on. And it's only through acts of resistance that we secured all of benefit. And so I left as an act of resistance. In addition, I left because leaving gives me more latitude to speak and write about the things I think are really important, like maintaining a decent set of living arrangements between humans and the rest of the planet in light of energy decline and global climate change. So those are three primary reasons I left the university. How did my colleagues react? As if I'd jumped onto the crazy wagon for the most part. I have very little interaction with my former colleagues. I've been largely ostracized. There's a rumor going around that it spread beyond the university where I was employed to universities around the country. And the rumor goes that my insanity, which is a given, of course, can be explained by a rare brain disease. And so there's a story going around that, you know, scientists are always looking for the mechanism, always looking for the underlying cause. Apparently the cause of my insanity is this rare brain disease. I haven't heard it labeled yet, but that's the story I've been hearing out there in the rumor mills.
For some reason, this reminds me of that Doonesbury cartoon about Ronald Reagan's brain. I mean, it is this whole industrial system that has a brain disease. We make nuclear plants that blow up. We make emissions that change the whole climate. We poison everything around us, and we don't care about it. Who has the brain disease?
One of Derek Jensen's premises underlying his book, Endgame, is industrial civilization and most of its members are insane. And I think that's about right. And I don't see how you can reach any other conclusion besides that one when you take a look around. But, of course, insanity is defined by what is viewed as normal in society. And what I've done is not normal. What most of my friends and colleagues and acquaintances and pretty much everybody else living in this country is doing is the opposite of what I'm doing. And so if normal is what everybody else is doing, then it's pretty clear that I am the crazy one.
Well, and you've captured some of your experience in your latest book, Walking Away from Empire, A Personal Journey. We haven't talked about that word empire. What do you mean by that?
An empire is a civilized set of living arrangements that requires obedience at home and oppression abroad, and whole-scale destruction of the living planet on which we depend for our lives. So an example might be particularly helpful. Personally, I think the last decent man in the Oval Office was a guy named Jimmy Carter, who, through his daily actions, demonstrated some decency for other human beings and at least a compassion or concern for soil loss and pollution and extinction of non-human species. And Jimmy Carter is known for the Carter Doctrine. The Carter Doctrine says that with respect to the Middle East, that's our oil over there. And by extension, all the world's, quote, resources are ours. Jimmy Carter, like Marcus Aurelius, was a thoughtful, wise, compassionate person who knew what it took to maintain an empire in decline. And so that means creating the world's largest killing force. Up until 1970, the United States didn't even have the world's largest military. The U.S. peaked in terms of oil production in 1970. And suddenly now we have a lethal force that is disproportionately huge compared to our human population in this country, compared to almost any metric you want to use. The number of people in this country, the number of people in the rest of the world, our geographical area, and so on. So if we're going to have an empire that depends upon resources from other places, oil and coal and food and so on, then we're going to have to get those somehow. And we can either write treaties, and we're not very good at that. The treaties that work out for us typically don't work out well for other countries. Or we can go get those resources at the point of a gun. And we're really, really good at that.
Well, you know, I don't just see this as an American empire. Sure, you know, there are hundreds and hundreds of bases all over the world, but Canada has its own imperial activities. For example, we direct major mining companies all over the world that are quite destructive. And, of course, the European countries have not just that history of empire, but they have corporate activities all over the world. It's kind of an industrial megastructure, as I see it, where half the world's people live in endless poverty, while we take their resources or even their working lives and we chew up their atmosphere. What is the future of this industrial empire as you see it?
Well, first of all, I agree wholeheartedly that it's not just the United States that has created and maintains an imperial set of living arrangements. But come on, Alex, we're number one. There's not much question about that, is there?
America is number one.
There's a bunch of countries that are trying to do what we're so successful at, which is deriving everything we think we need at the point of the gun so that we can buy anything and do anything. What is the end game for that set of living arrangements? Well, we're driving some 200 species a day to extinction. That's one of the artifacts of imperialism. We are destroying so many aspects of the planet that we actually depend upon for our survival. Every year we wash more soil into the world's oceans. Every year we pollute more water, we foul more air, and so on. Those are among the consequences. We don't call it slavery anymore. We call it exploitation when we have people creating the cheap plastic crap we need for 2 days' worth of happiness to be made in places like China and India and so on. And people are suffering and dying every day so that we can have Fritos and plastic toys that get played with for an hour or two. This is, all in all, it's difficult for me to imagine a more violent and horrific set of living arrangements. And yet, here we are, pushing for more, more, more. How does it end? Well, so far, it hasn't ended, and it keeps getting worse. Every year of my life has been worse than the year before. We've driven more species to extinction, we've dirtied more air, we've polluted more water, we've driven large carnivores off the cliff, and we've imprisoned and enslaved more people, and so on. I hope at some point we start seeing that turn around, that we see the world get better every year, that we see more carnivores next year than we saw last year, and more clean water and more clean air and less soil washed into the world's oceans, and so on and so forth. I think for that to happen, we're going to have to experience complete collapse of the industrial economy. I don't see anybody suggesting any other way that will get us to that point that actually scales at some large level. So for me, the first step was walking away from empire, which is analogous to, during the medieval period, people walking away from the king. Enough people do that, the king loses power. And so that's one step, but the next step is to start taking more action and more direct action in the spirit of Derek Jensen, for example, to terminate the set of living arrangements that is so horrific for people in non-industrial cultures and non-human species as well.
Well, now, Dr. Guy McPherson, you have expertise and have published books on both the environment and biology. Do you think the environmental situation is so serious that we should be thinking the possibility of extinction even for ourselves?
I not only think that we should be thinking about it, I think we've triggered extinction at our own hand as a result of climate change, or maybe as a result of environmental decay, or maybe as a result of nuclear catastrophe. We're pursuing each of those as rapidly as we can, and any of the three can lead to near-term human extinction. When I was editing a book on climate change 10 years ago now, I concluded that we probably were going to drive ourselves to extinction by 2030 because of climate change. About a year later, I discovered the notion of world peak oil, and I viewed it as a Hail Mary pass. Look, there's one thing that might terminate the industrial economy of the world and therefore give our species some hope of surviving beyond another couple of decades. But it's become pretty clear to me now that it's too late. Tim Garrett at the University of Utah wrote a paper that came out in Climatic Change in mid-November 2009. And in that paper, he concluded that only complete economic collapse prevents runaway greenhouse. That was 2.5 years ago. And the paper had been declined by several journals before it was published. So it was probably a few years in the making. I strongly suspect at this point that we've triggered so many positive feedbacks that extinction is baked into the cake for human beings. And that is a horrific and horrifically sad conclusion for me to reach. But I don't see much hope left in Pandora's jar.
Well, I used to believe energy depletion would take us down before the climate spun out of control, but now with gas fracking, the tar sands, we've got Arctic drilling ahead of us. I'm not so sure. What do you think?
I'm stunned at how long this system has persisted. And even though by any reasonable measure we're in the midst of an economic depression, we have still set records for greenhouse gas emissions each of the last 4 years. So 2011, we increased carbon emissions by 3.4% over 2010. 2010, we had increased 6.5% over 2009. 2009, we'd increased by 6.2% over the previous year, 2008, and so on. So climate change, it looks to me, is about as bad a Gatling gun as we could be possibly facing. And what are we doing about it? We're looking for more petrocarbons anywhere we can find them. And no matter what the cost, whether the cost is a completely destroyed Gulf of Mexico, whether it's drilling in the Arctic and releasing methane into the atmosphere, no matter the cost, we're willing to chase it down. It means destroying all of Alberta and destroying all the clean water along the way. Well, that's what it takes to maintain an empire, and in this case, it's a world empire, in decline. And so we're going to pursue that until we can't.
Well, we're some sort of meth addicts for fossil fuels. We will do anything, even though we can see that it's killing us. I find it very interesting that you mentioned Dr. Timothy Garrett. We did interview him twice on Radio EcoShock, and we had some great interviews with him where, indeed, as you say, he did scientific studies and calculations showing that just a complete collapse of our industrial economy was the only thing could save us from a climate catastrophe. Isn't it hard to call for the pain and suffering of what amounts to a super great depression, maybe unimaginable social dislocation, and say, that's our best hope?
Yes, and so I don't do that lightly. But I balance that tremendous amount of suffering that will bring to industrialized humans. I balance that with the tremendous amount of suffering we're bringing to people currently. We are causing an enormous amount of suffering to the roughly half the people in the world who don't live in industrialized nations, such as the United States and Japan and Western Europe. And for that matter, we're bringing quite a bit of suffering to the folks in Japan right now, and Greece, the birthplace of Western civilization. And on the list goes. So I understand the concern, and I'm empathetic enough and compassionate enough to recognize the suffering ahead will be horrible. On the other hand, I'm empathetic enough and compassionate enough to recognize that the suffering going on every day right now is horrible. And I haven't even mentioned the non-human species within the last couple of minutes. We're bringing horrible suffering to them as well. 200 species a day, that's genocide. This is not something we should be taking lightly. Albert Einstein said many years ago that 1 year without bees means the next year without humans. And colony collapse disorder is well underway. It appears that we're making a genuine effort to kill every non-industrial human species that we can find. And where does it end? Where do we decide the overshoot is too dire, the catastrophe from an environmental standpoint, including extinction, that's too dire? Where do we reach some sense of sanity to the whole situation and bring that to the table and say, okay, we're going to do something different and we're going to do it voluntarily? I don't know that we can get there voluntarily.
Yeah, you know, leaving the city, let's say, and going for a more self-reliant lifestyle, it's almost like choosing, for some people, for those of us who don't have a lot of money, it's like choosing voluntary peasanthood rather than participating in wrecking the world. Would you see it that way?
Absolutely. And there's a community a mile up the road from me that lives on a land trust, 13 people sharing 19 acres. The land was entrusted to the land trust as a gift. And they have a common well in the center of the property that's the only source of water. They carry water every day. They all live in off-grid housing, mostly houses they built themselves. And they could live in dire financial poverty anywhere in the country and perhaps anywhere in the world. But they choose to do that here. That they choose to do that is striking to most people I encounter. That they choose to do that here because this place is so beautiful, I think is quite the testimony to the people who occupy this particular part of the world. They're decent, compassionate human beings living in a beautiful place. So people can live in dire financial poverty and become largely independent of the industrial economy. And I see examples around me at every turn. It's not an impossible thing to pursue. It's not even a ridiculous thing to pursue.
It is something, though, that you have to be reasonably young to do it. We did it in the late 1970s. We lived for 10 years without electricity. We grew most of our own food and heat. But, you know, I see some people left that area and rural self-sustainability because they became old and they needed medical care and they went to where hospitals were, part of the old civilization. How will people handle that?
Well, that's an interesting point. The folks I just mentioned, the 13 people who share the land trust, I believe all have a living will and a will, and they depend upon their neighbors in ways that most people in industrialized society do not depend upon their neighbors. The age of the folks at the land trust goes up to about 80 years and includes children as young as eight years old, I believe. So it's quite a diverse community. None of those folks are dependent upon contemporary industrialized medical care, and they don't want to be. And so when it comes the time that it takes tubes and pumps and extraordinary measures, they're opting out. They're not going to live that way. Will we get to that point? Will other people willingly make that choice at some sort of large scale? I doubt it, even though when you talk to humans individually, even in industrialized societies, in my experience anyway, those people say, yeah, I wouldn't want to live if it meant ripping my chest open so you can do something to my heart. I wouldn't want to live if I get cancer coursing through my veins. I wouldn't want to live, and they give example after example. And yet those are exactly the kind of people we spend the majority of our money on trying to keep alive. So I'm not sure where to draw that line, where to balance those scales, as it were, between living a decent life and crossing to living, just living, instead of living a decent life that you actually enjoy. The folks at the Land Trust, I think, have given that considerable thought, and it's a topic of conversation that comes up pretty frequently with my neighbors, is how do we live and how do we die? I don't get that conversation much of any place else outside of this little relatively sparsely populated valley.
All right, let's talk about a technical detail, because life, if you're living a daily and trying to support yourself, is full of details that matter. In earlier emails, we talked about how solar power is really limited by the life of rather toxic batteries, which is about 10 years if you treat them right. The good solar panels are guaranteed for 25 years and may last a lot longer. I'm still thinking we could develop some tools that would run right off the solar panels without batteries, but I guess my underlying question for all that is clean energy just a bridge technology giving us time to go back to the past ways where humans have always lived?
That's certainly the way I view, quote, renewable technologies. And I say, quote, renewable because I think they're actually derivatives of oil. It takes an enormous amount of oil to make solar panels and wind turbines and to maintain those systems and so on. So that's the way we're treating it here on this 2.7 acres, is we are transitioning to a different century, and we are using solar pumps and solar panels to make that transition more gradual for us than it will be for many people who are going to be faced with no access to fossil fuels and no preparation for what to do without them in a relatively short period of time.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
My name is Mary Burton Risley, and I'm a fourth-generation New Mexican. We bought this 19 acres in 1981, and it was, 18 acres and 2 acres of water rights for $68,000. Could not do it today. And I always knew that I wanted to have a land trust community here because I had become very involved in nonviolence. And so I was thinking about ownership and how revolutionary a change it would be if we could shift the basis of ownership from wealth to usership, to stewardship, and if you could only own what you actually were using. Only became a land trust formally about 5 years ago. We became a nonprofit. And I had been holding out giving up the land to the land trust. We'd all been acting as if I had already given it. It was a real exercise of trust, I realize now. I think any kind of community that's worth its salt is always an exercise in trust. I think we've all learned a lot about conflict resolution. We had a conflict a few years ago. Amma wanted to get on the grid because she was building her house and she had power tools and she really didn't want to, couldn't afford to buy enough solar energy to run these power tools. So she wanted to hook onto the grid while she built her house. I was a little worried about it. My idea about that is that grid electricity means men with guns. I was a little worried about it because I didn't really know whether anybody else felt the way I did. And I was very pleased when we came to the meeting that three other people said that they felt strongly about not hooking onto the grid. But she was very gracious about it. Her house is beautiful, as you know. So,
Guy McPherson is a professor emeritus from the University of Arizona. He left to relocalize in the hills of New Mexico. Read all about it in his blog called Nature Bats Last. Guy, you've listed human community as one of the basic four needs. There's a new film in the works about some of the folks in your community. Tell us about the movie called Somewhere in New Mexico Before the End of Time.
Yeah, Michael Sowsoby is an independent filmmaker that I believe is his third career. He's living in Oceanside, California. He started following my work a few years ago and found it interesting that I would walk away from what looked like a pretty easy living kind of arrangement at the university, where I'd actually been banned from teaching in my home department. So, whereas Woody Allen says showing up is 80% of life, not showing up was 100% of my life at that point. I was really paid hush money to just not come to campus. So, and I chose to walk away from that, and Mike found that fascinating. So he came out and visited last fall, spent a couple of weeks here on the homestead and followed me around, shot some film, and I introduced him to several of the neighbors, including the folks at the Land Trust and the woman who runs the local coffee shop and so on and so forth. And so the longer he spent here, the more interested he became, and the more he thought this place was really very interesting because it was unlike anything he had encountered before. And so by the time he left, he had plenty of footage and plenty of questions and even more ideas. So we prepared an event just a couple of weeks ago. I was in Oceanside, California, and we did a bit more filming. And most recently, he's been filming other people who chose an alternative path, including Sherry Ackerman. I write with Sherry frequently at Transition Voice. And so he's interviewing a few other people who have chosen a different path, and I think coming to the conclusion that there is a more sane way to live than the way we've all been sold by contemporary culture. So as I understand it, that's the direction of the film. It's not a film about buying beans and bullets and holing up in your bunker as a survival strategy. It's about human community and the relations you develop and self-reliance at the community scale and how we might get there, sort of showing an example.
Somewhere in New Mexico Before the End of Time. When does that movie come out?
If it stays on track, it will come out sometime this autumn. I don't know exactly when. Mike has a majority of the footage done and is into the pretty serious editing phase, but he is targeting a fall release of the film.
Is there a website for it?
There's not. You can keep up with it on my website. I'll post updates, and that will take you to Mike's YouTube channel, where he posts the occasional trailer. There was an Indiegogo campaign that was completed a couple of weeks ago. So if you go to Indiegogo and search on Somewhere in New Mexico Before the End of Time, if you search on that, it'll take you to the trailers and you can sort of track the progress of the film there. But there is no website dedicated to the film.
Okay, and you mentioned also something called Transition Voices. Is there a website for that?
TransitionVoice.com is the online magazine for people interested in transitioning to a world characterized by climate change and energy depletion. And Sherry and I have been writing a monthly column for the last 3 months, I suppose, together, collaborating on a piece every month. And I've written a monthly essay for Transition Voice since they came into being some 2.5 years ago every month. So I have quite a few essays on there.
In my travels in America, which are limited lately but were more previously, I found that total communes are very rare in the United States. Most of the rural communities I've visited seem to be composed of self-contained homesteaders who meet up to exchange skills and produce, maybe. You talked about agrarian anarchy. Can you describe that?
Yes. Agrarian is relatively straightforward. I think that means the focus of daily life is on production and distribution of food, largely through growing your own, through horticulture, agriculture, whatever you want to call it, at small scale. Unlike the agriculture, the industrial agriculture that we have in this country and most other industrialized countries. So that's what agrarian is all about. Anarchy, for me, is just people taking responsibility for themselves and for their neighbors. And here, anarchy means taking responsibility for yourself and for your neighbors. And those neighbors are human and otherwise. Anarchy is not chaos. Anarchy is a set of living arrangements that ignores, or to the maximum possible extent anyway, ignores or escapes government and focuses instead on the human community as a source of the things we actually need, including the arts and music and food and water and so on. Some examples of writers who propounded agrarian anarchy include Henry David Thoreau, Ralph Waldo Emerson, and more recently Wendell Berry, who is still alive and an agrarian anarchist living in Kentucky. Howard Zinn was an anarchist, a famous historian who died within the last 18 months, I guess. And so there are some relatively famous examples of anarchy. Anarchy doesn't mean chaos, unlike what culture has been screaming at us for a decade or two now. It just means taking responsibility for yourself and for your neighbors. One of the significant voices and influences for me in my youth was a guy named Edward Abbey, who was living in Tucson and writing from the perspective of agrarian anarchy in the 1970s and 1980s. And Edward Abbey received his master's degree in philosophy at the University of New Mexico, where he wrote a thesis on anarchy and what anarchy and anarchism actually are. And it's not what most people come to believe it means in this country, in this society. That's agrarian anarchy for me, a focus on food production and distribution, and a strong reliance on your local human community instead of on the government. Anarchy is not Molotov cocktail throwing youth breaking windows in Seattle.
You know, part of my unpleasant job as an alleged truth-seeker host on Radio EcoShock is to ask the questions at the back of other people's minds, and here's one. If the biosphere is crashing along with the climate, as we say, why not just live the good life as long as we can? If it's so hopeless, why not party or at least live comfortably until we can't?
That's a great question, and I get asked it frequently. And people ask more pointedly, they say, why don't I just become a hedonist and party as the world burns? And when I'm responding to people from the United States, I say, so you're suggesting that Americans become hedonists? How would you tell the difference compared to what we're doing now? As nearly as I can tell, almost everybody in this country is doing everything they want, consequences be damned, regardless. So I'm not sure that it's really a relevant question in this day. I think that people will keep partying, will keep taking advantage of the world's reserve currency until it becomes worthless. And living more simply, as the line grows, so that others may simply live, is just not something we do in this country. That's not how we measure success. We measure success in this country by the amount of money a person has rather than by the amount of compassion they have. We measure a person's happiness by the value, the financial value of their car and their house rather than by the value of the interactions they have with other human beings and with the living planet. I'm not sure we can turn that around even one person at a time with the sort of rapidity that's needed to save what's left of the living planet. And that makes me pretty damn sad, actually.
Well, part of my answer, Guy, to that is that people, no matter what they say, when the price of oil becomes unaffordable for them, or when they lose their homes, or whatever the challenge may be, they will want to keep on living. And they will perhaps want to get out somewhere and try and grow their own food, but it takes a lot of time to make the mistakes you need to make to be able to do these things. You know, when I first went out to the country, I couldn't tell without the leaves on the trees which were the hardwoods which were going to burn well and which weren't. All sorts of things you have to do. You have to lose one crop to the early frost to figure out what you're going to do about that. So I do say to people now, try to become more self-sufficient, and if you can get out, because it's going to take you time to survive.
I absolutely agree with that. When I started this endeavor, I could barely distinguish between a screwdriver and a zucchini. That tells you everything you need to know about my building skills as well as my growing skills. I've been a lifelong academic. Went straight from high school to undergraduate school to graduate school to postdoc to first academic job to tenure track job, and I never really took a breath or looked around or learned any relevant skills with respect to self-reliance. So here we are about 4 years in to this project and 3.5 years since I left the university on a full-time basis. And now finally, after relying on the human community here to a very great extent, and also making just about every mistake a human being could make, I'm at the point where I can contribute to food production and preservation in this little valley. I can get water out of the ground and know that it's healthy water. I can now build a structure to keep some animals or even me in the shade during the heat of summer. I have developed relations with this human community here, and I depend heavily on them so that I don't have to figure out when the average last frost date is. My neighbors know that because they've been here for long enough to know that. So, again, reliance on your human community. I don't think there's such a thing as self-sufficiency at the level of an individual. There's self-reliance and a path towards self-sufficiency at the level of community. But we really, really should be depending upon each other in our communities to figure this stuff out. It's hard. It's so much more challenging than pushing electrons around on a screen and standing up in front of a classroom and telling stories. This real simple living, it takes a lot of work to figure out how to do. It's very rewarding when you take those steps and realize some accomplishments and grow your first potato. Those things are very rewarding. It seems simple enough, but trust me, not all that simple.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock, now broadcast by over 60 college and community radio stations in the United States, Canada, Britain, and Australia. I'm Alex Smith, saying, as we head into a crisis of energy, economy, and the environment, we need alternative voices more than ever. Please support your local nonprofit station.
I read an article in the Arizona Republic that was written by Guy McPherson. Yep. And my dad pointed it out to me, and I read it, and it talked about basically the end of the world as we know it, civilization as we know it. And that was another moment in my life where I went, wait a minute, because I had never questioned the way I actually lived daily. I questioned who I was. I was a white heterosexual male, but I never questioned about just getting up and how I live my life. And so a friend of mine and two friends of mine, myself, called Guy, had a conference call for about an hour, and again, we just listened. And there was a lot of silence on our end because about how, you know, this isn't going to last, and I had never thought about infinite growth on a finite planet. Something that seems so simple now, an equation that obviously doesn't work out, but I had never looked at it that way. And so I decided that I could no longer participate in the education system as I know it, the way I was doing it. So I knew I needed to get out of it, and I didn't know how. And so I Googled how to travel the world on a shoestring budget. Woofing came up, and I said, oh my God, I can live in somebody's place. They can teach me something, and I can work for food and shelter.
For me, it was more of like it was a win-win situation for everybody. I mean, I think woofing is a cool because we help people and they help us, but we don't really have to worry about the whole monetary thing. I don't want to live my life being dependent on that almighty dollar when I think that there's more to life than that.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Dr. Guy McPherson. Guy, it seems to me a part of the function of what you're doing and your local community is doing is to seed a lot of necessary ideas back into the rest of the hive. I mean, people come and visit you. People may come to your area and then they go, but they go with an experience of living off the grid, with ways to grow your own healthy food, to make do if the corporations don't provide a prepackaged life. Is your community a kind of transition nursery?
I'd like to think so, and I hope so. Within just a couple of months of living here, it occurred to me that there were several targets for my efforts here. One target was my wife and I to have a nice, decent, simple way of living in which we could maintain that decent, simple way of living. A second target was for the 9-year-old on the property here and his generation. So everything we built here, we built with durability in mind. And so we want these structures and these functions and this way of life to persist into his generation as well. And third was the general public. I was doing this as an example. So it wasn't just about me. So I've hosted more than 400 people here in the last few years and given them the tour of the property and shown what we can do, even though we didn't have the skills that it looks like now were necessary to pull this off. And of course, I take my show on the road, and I speak, and I write, and I try to demonstrate to people that it's possible to live more simply. It's more rewarding. It's perhaps even more healthy than relying upon Monsanto and ADM for your food to grow some of it yourself. So there's all kinds of benefits associated with this way of living, and using this place as an incubator is something that I've wanted to do for a long time and that I'm starting to do at a decent level now.
Do you see another book coming out of this?
It would surprise me if we had time left for the industrial economy to be printing and distributing books. You know, that's a year and a half at least from the time you submit the book until it comes out. And at this point, I'm focused more heavily on my writing for my blog and for Transition Voice and for speaking, for going out and visiting individuals in their communities and speaking at homesteads and to transition groups and to university audiences and so on. So trying to get my messages out in those ways instead of in book form. We'll see what the future holds, but at this point, I don't see a book in the near term.
Well, this is one of the things I really like about you, Guy. You don't hide what you're doing. You haven't stopped communicating. There is, as you say, a whole school of survivalists who sneak off to some secret bunker in Montana while writing off all the blind ants living their Walmart lives. But why? Why haven't you given up on the people still stuck in that dying paradigm?
Well, I suspect there's a couple of things there. First and foremost, there's my lack of free will. I've been a lifelong educator, and I just keep thinking, all evidence to the contrary, that I'll be able to reach somebody, and maybe a significant number of people in this society will do a 180 and follow this example. So that's one thing. I just can't seem to help myself. And equally importantly, I'm not interested in a Mad Max future that involves me and my beans and bullets in my bunker. That's no way to live. If that's what the future holds, I'm not particularly interested, thanks. I think that people who foresee that kind of future and who are interested in personal survival above all else are deluding themselves into thinking that's a life worth living. Maybe I'm the deluded one. It's certainly been suggested to me more than once, but I think we can live a decent, relatively simple life and share those experiences with other people.
So if some of our listeners suspect they are part of a killer system, maybe even keeping it going with their day jobs, if they want to walk away, how do they begin?
It's overwhelming. And when I interact with people, they point out all the reasons they can't do it. But ultimately, it comes down to four things we need over which we have some element of control. We don't have control at the level of individuals and human communities. We don't have control over air quality, for example, except at a very local level. So I would argue that we shouldn't focus on air so much, even though it's obviously pivotal for our survival, that instead we should focus on those four things that we do have control over and that do make our lives happy in the short run, the medium run, and the long run. So let's get together with other members of our community and secure our water and secure our food and make sure that we can all stay warm on a cold day and cool on a warm day and have fun doing it. I mean, if you're not having fun when you're while you are transitioning with your community to a decent, more survivable way to live for Homo sapiens, then I think you're doing something wrong, because this shouldn't be miserable. If you're doing this together with other human beings, this should not be miserable. We're all trying to reach the same goal, and that is a better world for our children and for their children. That shouldn't be a miserable experience for us. It shouldn't be the kind of thing we should be running away from. It's the kind of thing we should be running toward.
Yeah, in my time as a homesteader, I've never experienced so much music, so much art, so many interesting people and stimulating ideas. So definitely it's not a way of dying. It's a way of living. As we're getting here to our wrap-up point, Guy McPherson, I'm sure there's something I've missed or something that you would like to talk about that we haven't touched on. Does anything come to mind?
In addition to the rewards that come from this, what most people would call a simple way of living, in addition to those rewards, in addition to the benefits of walking away from empire before the empire walks away from you or even more horrifically oppresses you, there's something else we should be doing, in my opinion, and that is helping people not just transition to the next paradigm, but also helping tear down that old paradigm. That industrial paradigm that has allowed us to go into human population overshoot, that has allowed us to destroy our soil and our air and our water, that has allowed us to cause the extinction of many, many, many hundreds of species. We should be getting over that. Not only getting over that, we should be dismantling that system. Derek Jensen has written a lot about how to go about that, and he was preceded by a guy named Dave Foreman in the 1970s and one of his contemporaries, Edward Abbey. There are many things we can do that will make our lives more rewarding in the future. I tend to think of the industrial economy as a patient with a spurting wound out of a major artery. And the governments of the world are pumping on the heart, and the corporations are selling blood transfusions to the government to pump the blood in. And the environmentalists are running around with Q-tips cleaning up the sidewalk. And nobody's particularly focused on the patient, which is dying. And that's the living planet, which is dying every single day. Let's try to do something about the causes of death as we transition to a simpler way of living.
Dr. Guy McPherson is a professor emeritus at the University of Arizona. He's now living in rural New Mexico. He's experimenting to find a truly sustainable life. You can find his blog, Nature Bats Last, at guymcpherson.com, and I'd point out there's no A in McPherson. Or try his latest book, Walking Away from Empire, A Personal Journey. I put links to all that in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Guy, thank you so much for this wonderful hour encounter.
Thank you, Alex. It's been a real pleasure. I look forward to the next time.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
With the whole, when your muscles are strong, you will soon get along. to the land with its claim.